Hello, and welcome to Conversations with Lee Fulkerson, a series of podcasts from Plant Pure Nation. I'm Lee Fulkerson, and my guest today is Dr. Monica Agarwal. Dr. Agarwal is a board-certified cardiologist in Baltimore, Maryland. She has expertise in heart failure, pulmonary hypertension, and prevention. Her path in prevention started with a severe illness. It was then, with the fear that she would never practice medicine again, that she found her path to whole body medicine. One of her main focuses is educating people about the importance of plant-based nutrition and its benefits in treating and potentially reversing chronic illness. Welcome to the show, Dr. Agarwal.
Hi there. Good to talk to you.
Great. So what was your diet like growing up and as an adult before your illness?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I'm Indian by birth, and so my parents are vegetarian from India, and they came over, and they were so worried that we wouldn't fit into the American culture that they started feeding us meat. So my indoctrination into meat was McDonald's, because my parents actually didn't know where to get meat. They didn't really know much about it. And so they figured that's where everybody was going and that's what I should eat. So I grew up having a diet similar to sort of the most Americans, I would say, you know, learning how to, but I guess my first meat experience was at McDonald's. I remember my cheeseburger and French fries. And so that's how I started. Around when I was 16 years old, I decided that I didn't like the idea of eating animals, not by anybody's recommendation, but sort of was very environmentally aware and decided that it wasn't something for me. And so around 16, I decided to go vegetarian. But as you know, there are many poor vegetarians and vegetarians with poor eating habits, and I probably would be described as one of those. I remember years of being in college eating plain pasta and drinking Diet Coke, but I was vegetarian. So there were many years that I felt I was healthy with that kind of lifestyle. When I, you know, got a little older and a little smarter maybe, or a little bit more education on nutrition and medical school, I became a better vegetarian and definitely ate more plants, but still had a diet that was heavy in milk, cheese, and definitely had my share of junk. So that would be sort of the diet pre-getting sick.
Okay,
but,
so
you know,
now...
I was healthier than most people in the sense that mm-hmm. I really didn't eat, and I wasn't overweight, and I was very active, and I was a runner, and so I sort of felt like I had sort of the balance put together.
Great. So tell us about your illness and how it began and the symptoms you suffered.
Yeah, so I went through a phase because I went into cardiology, which is a subspecialty. I was in school for, it seems like forever in some ways. But most of us who do subspecialty medicine decide to have our children after we finished our training, which puts us a little bit older than a lot of other women. And anyone who wants to have more than one child all of a sudden feels the clock. And so I had three children in rapid succession. At one point, I had three children under 4.5.
Wow.
And so one in diapers at night, one in diapers in the day, who was 2, and then a newborn baby. Plus I was working full time as a physician and I remember nights of nursing the baby, answering calls for acute heart attacks, acute MIs, acute heart attacks, and trying to do sort of juggling all of this lack of sleep, trying to sort of figure out how to raise three children and all of this all at once. So I could definitely say at that time I was at my weakest point. So after I had my third child, I was 4.5 months postpartum, and I started developing migratory joint pain. It started out as pain in my knee, if I remember starting out, and then it was like, then it went away and went into my right my right hand. Then it migrated to my left shoulder. And being like any sensible physician, I diagnosed myself with Lyme disease because that can cause symptoms like this. And not seeing a physician myself, I decided to empirically treat myself with antibiotics, and I didn't get better. I'm a hiker. It just, everything fit. It just had, and I was camping and hiking even with my babies. So I thought that fit perfectly, but I didn't get better. And so I started getting nervous and started doing blood work. I hadn't gotten the blood work back, but I remember being so affected within just a couple of weeks' time, where I couldn't even button the clothes of the baby. Has those snaps on the, all their clothes.
Wow.
Have all those snaps, and I remember I couldn't even snap them. And I remember that there was one day in particular that I went downstairs and early in the morning hobbling because I felt like I had glass cutting through my feet. And I remember going downstairs to do some things in the kitchen for before the babies woke up, and the baby woke up, and I was trying to run up the stairs to get her because she needed to be nursed. And I couldn't even get up the stairs. I actually couldn't get up. And I remember crawling up the stairs. So within weeks, I had gone from sort of being this active, organized sort of woman postpartum to being almost completely dysfunctional. And it was around that time that I got my blood work back that showed that my rheumatoid markers were through the roof. So I went to see an esteemed rheumatologist, and who told me that my numbers were so abnormal that they overall suggested poor prognosis. It was a quite advanced and crippling disease, and that my numbers were pretty bad. So he told me to stop nursing my baby and get on advanced therapy within a week. So probably the hardest and darkest time of my life to date, you know, during this time, not understanding how this really could have happened, had a lot of those sort of patient issues. And it's the first time, interestingly, that I really understood what it meant to be sick. And
right.
I was mad. I was mean. I was mad at my kid. I was mad that I had a baby. Why did I have a third baby? Why did I push it? Why I was overdoing it? And I just, I had a lot of anger and a lot of guilt. It was a very sad time of my life. And
I can imagine. So essentially, rheumatoid arthritis was what it was then. Is that the case?
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Yeah.
That's a devastating illness, I know, and certainly really I can imagine what you were going through at the time. Must have been just terrible. So what sort of medications were you prescribed, and what were their side effects?
So I was put on so within a couple of days, I stopped nursing the baby, and I was put on steroids. And methotrexate. And methotrexate is a liver toxic medication that can cause not only liver toxicity, it can cause significant nausea and makes your hair fall out. So that I had all of that, it turns out. I became quite nauseated. I did lose a lot of hair. But, you know, you're hormonal and a lot of sort of post-pregnancy related, you lose the hair, but I lost a lot of hair, and I have a thick head of Indian hair, and it was just falling out in clumps. And my liver tests always were okay, and you have to get regular tests. Because I was on steroids, I had a lot of that excessive thirst, I gained weight. So those were the sort of main side effects that I felt.
So what led you to information about plant-based nutrition while this was going on?
So I got on these medicines and I started getting better, but I was worse because I had all these side effects, but I was better. So my joints started getting better and I started feeling a little bit more like myself again. And I went back to doing a lot of my clinical practice was sort of booming, and I was taking care of a lot of patients. And, I run a community screen, a heart screen, where every year we invite the community into the hospital and sort of educate them on illness, and we also do a screening. It's all free. And I had a woman come to me who was a plant-based nutrition coach who decided that she wanted to, and she's a friend now, Karen Fick, and she came to me and she wanted to be part of my heart screen. And I have to say, I was quite skeptical because she didn't have sort of the, she wasn't a nutritionist and I just didn't know who she was. And it's so interesting because you wonder why people show up in your life. And she showed up that day and she said, look, you know, I know you're skeptical about me. Why don't you let me do your profile? And I said, no, I'm fine. I don't need any help. And being very sort of protective of my own personal information and never wanting to share, you know, because I'm a physician, right? And so I didn't want to share any of my personal information. And so I kind of left it. But then after some prodding, she recommended it and I gave it a go. And the things she recommended were astounding and sort of talking about inflammation in milk and talking about sort of how diet causes inflammation. And it started me on this path really where I started needed to figure out what's this all about. The reality is in medical school, most physicians will tell you that they receive nearly almost no nutrition education, which is sad and ironic because we are the ones prescribing so many lifestyle changes, but we don't get a lot of education. Now we're working on a global level, a national level rather, to affect change, but we don't get a lot of education in medical school. And that, like I said, that's changed in the last decade and it is continuing to change. But I had to do a lot of self-learning, and I did an integrative fellowship at the University of Arizona, and so I'd learned some nutrition with Dr. Andrew Weil, and so I'd done I had gotten some education from there, and then I started doing a lot of education on my own, and I changed my diet. I cut out milk and cheese, which I loved more than anything. I cut out cheese, and I would tell you the first few days I thought this is not possible. But then you start feeling better, isn't it? And you start feeling better and amazing and you can't even believe the difference. And that's exactly what happened to me. And I think it was probably a year and a half, I think, after I started on Medicaid, maybe a year after I started on the methotrexate that I switched and then to adding plants into my diet. Exclusively plants and no dairy. Mm-hmm. And I think dairy was my trigger and is highly inflammatory, as you know, and was my trigger. And so I cut that out completely and went completely vegan, but healthy vegan. I completely plant-based. And within 3 months, I was a different person. I felt so much better. It was amazing. It was actually amazing.
Really fast, amazing story. And you know, you hear that from a lot of people, but it depends. The speed with which it happens varies. But that that must have been a revelation to you, and it must have given you a lot of hope. When and how did you begin to reduce or eliminate your medications?
So that's a tricky thing because you often wonder, and as a scientist, I've debated, am I better because I've just been taking the DMARDs or the disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, which is one of which is methotrexate, or is it because I got on a plant-based, but more plant-based healthy diet with a lot of anti-inflammatory spices, and what was the difference? And so, you know, this is always what's tricky with just one case. When you look at each individual. And so this is something we all struggle with because there's unfortunately not a lot of nutrition studies out and sort of elimination diets. And but that, of course, is also slowly changing. But so I did debate about this. So with the help of a rheumatologist, which I had to switch rheumatologists, but I was able to sort of talk about, because most rheumatologists will say that there is no cure for rheumatoid arthritis.
Exactly.
And this is always the dilemma, which is that it's a clinical diagnosis. We don't follow markers, but it's also not curative. And so they will tell you that even if you stop your drugs and you might be fine for a little while, it will eventually come back. And so this is something that I wondered and struggled with quite a bit. And so I think that when people call, because people contact me all the time and say, well, I would like to do what you did. I always say that that has to be done with caution, because there's many, I'm quite conflicted about reducing medication, when everybody's time to reduce medications is very individual, and it needs to be done, I think, with the care of a good physician. So I found a physician who was able to work with me and understand what I wanted to do. And together we started going down on the meds, but we did it very slowly. And I'm saying like 2.5 milligrams every 3 months. So that's how slowly we came down. And it took me almost a year to come off of the medicine. But I'm okay with that, because as a scientist, I needed to also be sure that it wasn't the drugs that were making me better. I'm happy to say that I've been off medicine now 2 years. You know, I'm a triathlete now. I do yoga all the time. I feel better and stronger than maybe I ever have. But it was a careful and slow process weaning the medications.
And how were you able to find a rheumatologist that was on the same boat that you were, so to speak? Was that a difficult process to find, or were
it is
somebody...
It is, you know, it is a difficult process, and because I get that question a lot, is where can I find somebody who will help me with this? And yeah, it is tricky. So a lot of allopathic physicians will not consider diet as a change in terms of improving and removing a sort of way to get off of medication. And a lot of them will just not consider it, which is why I had to switch rheumatologists. But most people, so that is a tricky thing. But I think if you, they are around. I know a few that are around that are strong advocates of diet without also then being jumping from one to the other. So,
right.
You know, I believe in the microbiome, and that the microbiome is often the trigger for the leaky gut, which triggers inflammation and then causes autoimmune disease. So if you believe that the gut is sort of the source of a lot of the inflammation, then it takes time for that gut to heal. And so I think that one thing I do want people to understand is that if you've had illness for some time, there's so many inflammatory markers. And so you cannot sort of just go from being on medicine to not being on medicine just like that, because it takes time for the gut to heal. And that's why it is so individual, and that some people take years to heal the gut, whereas some people maybe who've had the illness for less time can transition or feel better sooner. And I think that that's sometimes tricky for people. And sometimes you're so inflamed when you first get diagnosed that you can't just use plant-based diet, and that you have to sometimes be on medication and then use the diet as a supplement and then slowly wean off medicine. So it really does depend on each case, I think.
So presumably during this time, you were also getting blood tests. Were your the markers for the rheumatoid arthritis going down? And how was that sort of mirroring, you know, the way you were coming off your medication? Or what was the sort of story that was painted by that?
So, again, see, the thing about rheumatoid is that since it is a clinical diagnosis, those markers are difficult to follow, and that's something that I'd like to study, actually, and have thought about doing a small clinical trial on following these markers more, because most rheumatologists will tell you that the rheumatoid factor and the anti-CCP antibody don't correlate with active flare, but they will sort of argue that eventually these numbers should then come down if you have improved, but it's just maybe slower to respond. So my numbers, I did check my markers because I was a bit compulsive and needed to sort of understand, and I did notice my numbers came down, but I also think that that has to be taken with a grain of salt, because I'm not sure. Clinically, I think the diagnosis is clinical, and so if you're clinically absent of inflammation, then the numbers don't always follow. Now, the ESR and the CRP, which are inflammatory markers, should respond and correlate with how you feel. If you're having inflammation in your joints, your inflammatory markers will be higher, your ESR and your CRP. But if you don't have inflammation in your joints, those numbers should be flat. And so those numbers should correspond to how you feel, whereas those rheumatoid factor and anti-CCP antibody may not. Mine happen to correlate, but not everybody's will correlate. And like I said, most rheumatologists will say not to follow those numbers as you flare.
So in any event, the big sign is that you're absent of inflammation, and then so you're fine. Presumably your markers are flat now. Is that the case?
That's correct. No, I've checked, and my inflammatory markers are flat.
Okay. So when and why did you start recommending plant-based nutrition to your patients?
So as I started learning about a plant-based diet, and it's for me, plant-based diet is so multifaceted. It's about anti-inflammatory spices. It's about eliminating the right foods, but adding back so much of the good, and which, how much, what omega-3 fatty acids, and getting in sort of those anti-inflammatory seeds. And so it's really, you know, adding, making that diet really sort of balanced in that way. But once I started reading and literally understanding about oils and trying to, and this has been a several year process of understanding how what needs to be eliminated and what needs to be added back, I started seeing and understanding a lot of the impact on heart disease. Dean Ornish has written some small, you know, studies back in the 80s, but plus, you know, Esselstyn's new stuff. I mean, there's just so many things out there now that, and then there's a new article in one of our big journals, the New England Journal, which talks about how meat triggers this metabolite called TMAO, which actually is associated with increased heart disease risk. So there's so many sort of new links between the food that we're eating and heart disease. So I started changing my patients' diets according to things that I understood, and using a lot of elimination. And a lot of times in the standard diet, more of the, if we can eliminate some of these toxic foods and then do the add back, people see remarkable differences. And I did this for years with my patients, and the stories I could tell you of patients coming back to me, telling me these stories, I mean, they'll tell you their asthma got better, their acne got better, their joints got better. And oh, by the way, their cholesterol got better, you know, the stuff that I would be weaning off their cholesterol meds. But then on the same time, they'd be telling me about all these other things. I mean, I could tell you a really nice story if we have a moment.
Yeah.
Do we have a moment? Yeah, sure.
So Absolutely.
I have this one patient who came in to who I had been following for years, a lovely gentleman, probably in his 70s, and he was admitted to another hospital, not mine, because he was having a stomach bleed, or we call it a GI bleed or a stomach bleed. And while he was having the bleeding from his bottom, he also started developing chest pain or angina. And so he was admitted to the hospital over there, and they gave him blood products because he was bleeding, and they were able to control the bleeding in his from his bottom, and they did, and his blood counts improved. And then they did a stress test on him, and the stress test was abnormal. So a stress test is done to assess for if there are blockages in the heart, and the stress test showed it had multiple areas of blockage. So they recommended a heart catheterization, which is a procedure where we go in through the leg and we go up to the heart and we look for clogged arteries. So it's invasive, but if you find a blockage, then you actually have to put people on blood thinners because you get a stent and then you need blood thinners, but then blood thinners would make him bleed again through his bottom. So we weren't going to necessarily solve our problem, but they recommended a heart catheterization. So he called me and he said, look, I've been admitted at this hospital. What do you think I should do? Should I have this cath? And I say, you know, I'm not sure that that's the right decision. In fact, I probably, you know, I'm not seeing you directly, so it's hard for me to say, but it seems to me that the catheterization may worsen the problem. So he left the hospital against medical advice, and then he came in, which I did not recommend, but he did, and he came over to my clinic the next morning. And we talked about his diet, and we talked about bleeding and why bleeding happens. And a lot of the medicines that we use when we do a heart catheterization cause bleeding. And so I didn't want to do a procedure that would cause bleeding. when he already was prone to bleeding. So I changed his diet. We spent hours together working on figuring out about fiber and learning about inflammation. And he would literally bring me packages and say, is this okay? Is that okay? And so over a 3-week period, we changed his diet. And he, when he left the hospital from the other hospital, he was put out on stool softeners. And 3 weeks later, he came to me and he says, you know, I'm doing so well, but I'm pooping all the time. And I was like, oh, okay, stop all the stool softeners. He's like, but he wasn't having any bleeding and he wasn't having any chest pain. So then over a couple more weeks and 6 weeks later and 3 months later, still doing really well, no chest pain at all, feeling really good, bowels working well and no bleeding. And at 3 months later, I was able to wean him off of a lot of his medications. And by 6 months later, I repeated a stress test and it was normal.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that the impact of disease and sometimes realizing that some less is more is important. And patients, when they follow and adhere and they see how good they're doing and how well they're doing, it's amazing to see the light in their face when they know that they're healing.
Well, it's amazing to me, too, that he was at that age. You'd think that somebody at that age, it might be sort of like, well, that boat has sailed. It's too late for that person to make any sort of get any kind of improvement out of a dietary change. But that clearly wasn't the case in this.
Yeah, it's never too late. It's never. I have people in their 70s. Now, it's harder to change people's routine. That is very difficult. However, if you can get people to make the change, it's amazing. I find that it's never too late. The number of patients, I've done the same diet in my 30-year-olds as I've done it with my 70-year-olds, and it's never too late.
So when you first started giving this information to patients, what was their attitude towards the dietary recommendations? Were they skeptical or were they open-minded?
You know, it depends. I find that the more senior people would definitely be more skeptical. I also am in downtown Baltimore, where it's a heavy meat area. And so the idea of sort of cutting out meat products was quite foreign. But I've never been a drastic person because I've learned, maybe because I have small kids or maybe because I myself have gone through illness, that things take time. And I think that if you show somebody and say something, everything you're doing is wrong. I want you to do all of these things instead. That it's a turn off and it's overwhelming and people can't, it's hard to handle. So I have found that I do gradual changes with my patients and I would slowly educate them with the goal of not overwhelming and eliminate a few things at once where I'd say, okay, let's start by eliminating just red meat. And that would be very difficult for some patients. And so we would start with sort of basic things and I would see them regularly and we would talk about sort of the benefits and what I wanted them to add back. And sometimes we would do just a few things at a time. And some people it would take 6 months to a year before we were able to make a lot of the changes. But I think if you as a doctor are willing to work with the patient, patients often are willing to work with you.
I think that's a great approach. I mean, it seems to me that's really the smart way to do it. Like you say, if you hit them with everything at once, that's going to be really easy for them to say no. I mean, it's going to be shocking to try and get their minds around a gigantic change to their lifestyle.
For sure.
But
yeah.
When you do it one little thing at a time, that's probably seems to me the really smart way to go.
I think so. I mean, it's worked for me anyway.
What about your family? Are they plant-based or what is their attitude about all this?
Yeah, my family is primarily plant-based. My children, I have 3 small children, and I cook only plant-based foods. And they eat, I'm Indian, so there's a lot of Indian food, a lot of lentils and grains. And so my kids overall eat really well. But if you ask me, do they deviate? Yeah, because, you know, I'm also not a dictator. I've learned also that I want my children to love the foods they eat, and they also but are curious and they're young and they're trying to figure it out. And so if they go out and they choose to eat something that I don't typically want them to eat. I absolutely nothing, because I don't run a dictatorship in my household. And so I want them to try what they want to try, and they do, and they try what they like. And what I found is, though, over the last year or two, is that even though they try these things, most of the time they always come back to the foods that they eat at home. And so I think the point of the story is that I think what you feed them at home really makes a difference. And if you feed them foods that they're, that my kids will prefer, like, I, you know, I make a lot of dal, which is lentils, so lentils and rice. My kids will, you know, will prefer lentils and rice over most sort of standard kid foods any day of the week, because, I mean, what you eat at home is what makes you comfortable and what you like. You know,
right.
So I find, you know, I find that it's okay. Like, it's okay to let them explore. Not everybody agrees with that, but I let my kids explore, let them try what they try. And I'm hoping that because I've created a nurturing and healthy environment at home, that they're going to come back and shift towards the foods that I teach them and recommend to them. And overall, that's what's happened. I mean, it's really neat to see. I mean, my kids like kale. I mean, kids don't like kale, do they? I mean, my kids like kale and spinach and you know, they like lentils, and, you know, that this is a food they eat. But do they like mac and cheese once in a while? Yeah. So, but I don't. Yeah, I don't say anything.
Yeah, I hear you. So what are their ages now?
I have a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 9-year-old.
Okay. So the 9-year-old is out with friends and stuff like that, and sometimes will undoubtedly try things that that their friends are eating. But I think, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting that the oldest, actually, my son, is the least interested in meat and actually rarely eats anything. Actually, yeah, it's interesting. But I think because for him, he was with me so much at home eating. I think I fed him lentils when he was 9 months old. Like, he has been eating, he's been eating lentils and chickpeas and hummus since he was 6 months old. It's amazing to me. But yeah, so he, 9 months. But it's, yeah, but it's true. When the kids go out and they hang out with their friends and the friends are eating something, sometimes they try it, and sometimes they like it and sometimes they don't. But I find more often they don't like it, which is interesting.
That is interesting. What about ice cream? Are they,
ice cream is always a weakness. In our house, the kids still intermittently will eat ice cream. But I try to change it up. Like, I make them coconut ice cream, and we do almond milk shakes. You know, like, my kids like milkshakes, so we do almond milkshakes, and they like them. I use cocoa, and I try to make chocolate milkshakes with just fresh cocoa and sugar and almond milk, and they really like that. And then you can make those into little ice creams. You can pour them into the little casings and make them into ice cream. And so that they really like that. So, you know, we've come up with clever ways to sort of give them the foods and the healthier options. I make brownies for them all the time, but I make them with almond milk and applesauce, or they like brownies, or I'll make them banana bread or pumpkin bread, but I use applesauce, and I don't use egg. And sometimes they'll say, "Mommy, this is a hit." "Mommy, I didn't like this one."
they'll certainly let you know, I guess, if they don't like them.
Oh, yeah. I get the frown within 2 seconds, so I'll know if I screwed up or not.
What about other cardiologists that you know? Do they share your enthusiasm for plant-based nutrition as a treatment for their patients?
So, you know, so I would tell you that there's the full spectrum. I have known physicians and have good friends of mine that are physicians that say, "Give me my steak and give me my Crestor too." Crestor is a statin medication. So I definitely have that. So much to the fact that, so I definitely have that kind of partner and colleague that I've worked with. And there are many, unfortunately, like that. But then there are also people that are sort of aware and want to change, but don't know enough and want to understand and learn. And then there are the few, and that we are a limited few, that actually feel strongly and do advocate it. And I'm part of the American College of Cardiology and Nutrition Committee, which is an honor to be part of that, and just incredible people on that committee. And we're a small group, but everybody has just fabulous energy and a lot of plant-based physicians on there and a lot of plant-based cardiologists. And so because of that, I do have an environment of people where we can, you know, bounce ideas off of each other and sort of be passionate about our diet. So, yes, we are a small group, but we are strong in passion.
Now, is the goal of that group to spread this message among other cardiologists and to disseminate, you know, scientific information about its efficacy and things of that nature?
Well, that's exactly right, yeah. So the American College of Cardiology is sort of the big group for cardiologists. So we all, overall, a lot of us are part of this society, mm-hmm. and they affect national standards in cardiology. And so part of that is we have, you know, our group is trying to bring nutrition and nutrition education into the cardiology world more than it is. It really isn't part of it. And so we've just sort of making it sort of more of an important role, mm-hmm. and we're trying to affect national standards, but we're working at hospitals. So I don't know if you know this, but hospitals right now, we treat people for their heart attack, and then the cafeteria brings the lunch up and it's a hamburger. And
I've heard that story a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yes, so it's so painful. And so we're trying to affect national standards in hospitals. We would like to, I mean, we have a lot of ambitions to sort of get the word out on multiple levels and, you know, eventually get into the schools in terms of education, the schools about how to eat better, and, you know, also internationally.
So this was this group formed under the auspices of the College of Cardiology nationwide? I mean, does it have support from the leadership then?
That's correct. Uh-huh. So it's the American College of Cardiology, and underneath that we have multiple groups, the Women's Heart, and we are the Nutrition Committee.
That's interesting. The top people in the organization were open enough to the idea to form this committee, or did you just sort of take it upon yourself to form it and then get their blessing?
Oh, no, yeah. No, I can't take credit for the formation. There are about 10 or 12 of us on the group, really sort of esteemed people in the community. It came about, yes, from the sort of administration level, where some of the group of cardiologists were saying, look, we need this. This needs to be an important part of the American College. And then it became its own entity, and it's just sort of taken off from there.
So given that, what do you think the future holds for the greater adoption of plant-based nutrition as a treatment for chronic disease?
I think it's really promising.
Yeah,
I think it's promising. I really do. I mean, I think overall, so if you look at education in 2016 or of cardiologists, they would tell you that 10 years ago there was almost no education about nutrition, and people wouldn't know about what MyPlate is, or plant-based diet, or vegan diet, or gluten-free, or whatever the multiple sort of diets they wouldn't know. But that's changing. You know, people nowadays would tell you that they are definitely getting more information in their schools. Some medical schools have started culinary practices where their mm-hmm. medical students are learning about cooking and how to cook and how to recommend things to their patients. And slowly, I think that there's going to be more and more clinical trials on this. And I mean, clinical trials are so tricky because clinical trials are extremely expensive, and mm-hmm. you need a lot of money to put up a trial. And a lot of drug companies or pharma companies pay for or partial portions of trials. And so that's nice when you have a drug that you're comparing. But when you're comparing diet, that's not interesting to pharma because it's the anti-pharma.
there's not a lot of money in that. And as a matter of fact, it's kind of working against their interests if they find a that it's more effective.
That's exactly right, right. And so there is, you know, people doing NIH-funded work, and slowly, but, you know, government funding is hard to come by.
So do you think we've reached the tipping point in this country in terms of the acceptance of plant-based nutrition? And this is among the public.
That's an interesting question. I would say that we're definitely building up, but I don't think we've hit that point yet. I think we're.
Yeah.
I'm seeing from 5 years ago until to now, there's definitely so much more awareness. But I think that's also kind of skewed. Like we all live in this plant-based environment. So the people around us that become our friends and our colleagues are very focused on that same thing. So we think that it's, and you know, but there are also, you know, all these great documentaries coming out, and Forks Over Knives, and some of these new ones, and Plant Pure Nation, of course, and all. And so that's exciting, but I'm just not sure that that's hit mainstream yet. But I think it's getting really close. If it hasn't hit, maybe it has. In retrospect, we'll look back and say, yay, it was 2016. But I don't know. I'm not sure. But I if it is or not. But if we're not there, we're definitely getting close. I think there's a lot of America that is not familiar with plant-based. And, you know, my kids still come home with telling me that there are five food groups. There's the meat group. There's the dairy group. And this is 2016 elementary school. They're still telling me that there's a meat group and a dairy group.
Right.
I'm like, well, it's really not the meat group. It's the protein group. And it's not the dairy group, you know, and so just sort of getting through and sort of re-educating. But that's 2016 school, so I still think we have so much further to go.
Right. Well, I got to compliment you on being part of moving that train forward. And I'm particularly thankful that you shared your story, and you know, I'm happy that you're well now and don't have that debilitating illness anymore, because that just
tragic. I think the more people on the ship, the faster it will turn.
There you go. So Dr. Agarwal, thank you very much for being on, and I appreciate you sharing your story with everyone, and hopefully, you know, we'll have a chance to talk again later on, and we can update all of this and see where things have gone. So thank
That'd
you
nice.
For,
yeah.
for you. Great.
My pleasure.
So just a reminder for everybody out there, if you want to get involved, please join a local Plant Pure pod or form one yourself if there isn't one around. An easy way to do this is to go to our website, plantpurenation.com, and follow the links, and you'll find out about the pod program and where one is in your local area, or if there isn't one, how to form one, and hopefully you can become part of the solution too. So thanks, and we will see you next time.